all bald men from the past. Richard, Leif Erikson, Napoleon. A hobby of yours, such men? I am honored. Thank you. But I caution you. Such men dare take what they want.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry, and as always, I'm joined by Derek.
Hello.
And by Graham.
Hello.
And by some wonderful children playing in Graham's neighbouring garden, and that's absolutely fine, because I think it's fine. Maybe we need to call the police. I don't know. We'll play that by ear. We're sitting in Graham's garden because it's a beautiful July day. We're emerging from the chrysalis, which was the UK lockdown of 2020, if you're listening to this in the future. And we're here to talk about Star Trek, the original series, specifically one episode, and that is the episode called Space Seed. Graham, this is an episode that we talk about impact and legacy. I mean, there are a few episodes that have a greater impact and leave a finer legacy than Space Seed.
Yeah, I think it's got to be one of the go-to episodes that people remember from the original series, even if you're not that familiar with it. Obviously, it had a sequel. It had a film sequel, no less than that. And it's had two, isn't it, effectively? Effectively, it has. But it's certainly something that sparks the imagination. It sort of talks about the near future of Earth as well at the time. Of course, that it's set in an era that has now, in our time frame, passed. But it also gives the idea of an alternative near future for what was 1960s America. I think it does. Those sort of things, I think, trigger memories more than others. So for stories that are on strange new worlds with strange civilizations, they can be very entertaining, but they don't say something directly about the human condition at the time, whereas Space Seed obviously does. And there is the historical reference as well of the fact of history repeating itself with the name Botany Bay.
Absolutely. And also the idea of history repeating itself again in respect to the eugenics wars, because this is clearly a war fought amongst genetically engineered people, a race of supermen that was generated by, you know, ambitious people, and clearly a reference to the Nazis,
yes,
and the Second World War. And the Nazis, you know, own ideas about, you know, evolution and about the nature of humankind. And it plays into that, and what it's telling us is that we didn't really learn any of the lessons, I guess, from the Second World War in the respect of the dangers and ills of Nazism.
It's quite an interesting episode because, as you said, it's an interesting episode because it refers back to the history of the Federation and to Earth in general. But when you were watching this first time round, it's actually playing on the future, the near future. And if you look at the time frame, this was filmed in, is it 1966, is this episode? Mm-hmm. And you're only 21 years away from the end of World War II. But the time frame that they've actually said that the Third World War was going to happen, which is basically, you know, 20 to 30 years in the future from that period of time when you're actually watching this. So you're right in the middle when you're actually watching this between two major conflicts.
Yeah.
You're still suffering the reverberations from, you know, the impact of World War II and the idea about eugenics, which was seen as being a valid type of science from the, in the early part of the 20th century. And you know, the idea about supermen. I mean, one of the biggest, you know, cultural figures at the time is actually called Superman. And I suppose is that during the 60s we were going through periods of time when people, and science fiction was the perfect playground for this, to actually investigate the human condition about, can we create better people who aren't as barbaric as this conflict that we had like 20 years previously, or are we going to make the same mistakes? And this is always the thing about genetics, and you know, and you know, with the Roddenberry thing, the sort of, there's an ethos that goes through it about humanity can get better, but without the need for the you know, to make the mistakes that we've made in World War II with Nazism, you know, and Nietzsche type philosophies. You know, that's where a lot of this sort of stuff comes into.
Well, in fairness, there's in those, particularly in that first season of TOS, you also have that philosophy of struggle,
yes,
don't you? And yep, like, you know, mankind is meant to struggle. This side of paradise is an episode that we were going to do, we didn't end up doing it.
Yeah.
There's a massive sort of like philosophical clash going on there between sort of like, you know, these guys had these wonderful spores where they could just like live off the land and everything was great and they were happy. And Kirk comes along and ruins everything. He says, well, that's not how you do things. You don't improve artificially.
No.
And Space Seed is saying the same thing, isn't it? It's saying, yes, you don't improve artificially, you improve through struggle.
Yeah, and also as well, they don't really like Khan's protestation that he brought peace.
yeah, and order.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really. I mean, it's because the eugenics thing kept going, and that goes all the way into Deep Space Nine as well. Actually, I mean, it's a. I mean, this is why this is an important episode as well, is because I think. It's because it acts as a sort of ideological pillar within the franchise as it became. Obviously, it wasn't just a TV show back then, but when it turned into a franchise, sort of other creators looked at the eugenics wars as a moment in this fictional history that they can then pin other values, sort of like associated to Star Trek, on it, and use that as an example and as a trope to put across that argument. Go on.
Well, remember. I mean, there was a tagline for the motion picture. The human adventure begins. It's not the superhuman adventure that begins. This is the thing about Star Trek. It's about the human adventure and us, you know, improving ourselves, but as human beings, in all different ways, you know, sort of whether it's sort of being kind, being anti-racist, as you know, they're showing a multicultural sort of crew. That's an interesting thing that they actually show in the when they actually get onto Botany Bay. Spotty Scotty talks about the crew of people in suspended animation were from lots of different nations, which is quite interesting. And there is an interesting thing later on as well, where a lot of the human crew, the senior members of the crew, actually profess to have an admiration for Khan when they
find
out.
That was a good scene. Yeah,
that was a very good
scene.
That
kind of sneaking admiration that is reminiscent of listening to people who tend to talk about the war.
Gentlemen, this romanticism about a ruthless dictator is.
But Spock, we humans have a streak of barbarism in us, appalling, but there nevertheless.
There were no massacres under his rule.
And as little freedom. No wars until he was attacked. Gentlemen.
In my opinion, again, sort of like there's this perception of sort of like the nobility of the enemy. Yeah. And you get that with the German army, I think. Mm-hmm. A lot of that, that's kind of, you know, that
it's the sort of conversation you get with people who are in the military, like everyone is in Star Trek.
Like everyone is in Star Trek. I was going to say something, but I will say it now. In case I forget. I mean, the principle, obviously, of the superiority of the human spirit and human endeavor over genetically engineered humans, over superhuman. The message is very clear at the end, of course, because Kirk wins, and he wins because ultimately he understands. Khan berates him during the saying, "You haven't evolved at all."
Captain, although your abilities intrigue me, You are quite honestly inferior, mentally, physically. In fact, I am surprised how little improvement there has been in human evolution. Or there has been technical advancement, but how little man himself has changed.
You know, your technology has evolved you, nothing else. And he's trying to argue that actually you're no different to what you would have been 300 years ago or 200 years ago. You've just invented all of these machines. And I don't think that argument is necessarily settled, but what Kirk does is he beats Khan. He beats Khan because he just has more experience, because he's lived the life, he's lived a better life. And more importantly, he knows where the
big iron bars are.
And Khan doesn't. Khan focused on, you know, the base, you know, the essentials when he was studying the tactical manuals. But Kirk knows his ship like the back of his hand and knows where that bar is and was able to beat Khan, albeit in a rather unconvincing manner.
Well, he didn't. He's obvious stunt double.
He's obvious stunt double.
Oh, it was. Yeah, that was a real standard.
That really wasn't made for like large format TVs.
It really wasn't, was it? And the iron pipe was quite unconvincing as well. He was wielding it way too freely, I think. But anyway, these are small matters. Let's crack on with some of the nitty gritty. Then let's talk about Ricardo Montalban. Let's talk about Khan.
Yeah,
because he's just such an immense figure in every sense. Obviously, we're going to see him again later in another movie. Cast by Ricardo Montalban. Let's just talk a little bit about Ricardo Montalban, the actor. I mean, a prodigious actor. In mostly, you would say, TV and some movies up until that point. Probably, I think he'd done a bit of a... Had he done a run on Bonanza, or was he just that guest star?
I think he was just a guest star there.
Think I get the impression that he probably ended up being the kind of guy who was cast playing Native Americans back in 1960s movies and shows, because he's Mexican.
But to be honest, he has played nearly every single nation as well. I mean, he goes on in... I read a little bit about his career, and one of his favourite roles, he played a Japanese dancer in a film called Sayonara, which actually won some awards.
Sayonara, perhaps?
Sayonara, yeah. And it won some awards. He's played everyone, like French people, sort of, as in this episode of Star Trek. Obviously, he's a Sikh, you know.
Yes.
Which
he
is a really
a Sikh.
Yes.
You know. Not a Mexican.
Not a Mexican.
I think that's interesting, because I wonder if his casting had anything to do with Desi Arnaz being one of the driving forces behind Star Trek. I know that him and Lucille Ball didn't have any hands on in the series, but they were obviously the ones who stumped up the cash for it, didn't they?
Well, he had a career very early on, and so he 70 years in of acting, and he before he made it really big in TV, he actually had a movie career, and he was actually signed to MGM for a long
period. He's a studio actor.
As a studio actor.
Was that in Mexico or in...
No, in Hollywood, because he did start off... his early life was, is he came to, he was born in Mexico, but in his teenager years he moved to New York, and he ended up doing theatre work and also appearing in, there used to be this hand cranking 10-minute little movies in the old projectors, you know, like the in the seaside stuff. That's where he started. It was a big thing in New York.
We know the kind of things you mean, don't we?
Yeah. Not what the butler saw, but in America it was actually just entertainment with lots of dancing and stuff like this. And he was this guy could do everything. He could dance, he could sing, you know, obviously he could play brooding Sikh superhumans, you know. But he started off as a dancer. I mean, he did a long period of The King and I, as you could probably imagine, playing The King and I on stage.
Yul Brynner did it.
Yul Brynner did it, exactly. And so this guy has played... I wouldn't be surprised if he's actually played an Irishman.
He sounds to me, Graham, like he represents the kind of actor that Hollywood would pass to play a bluntly a person of colour,
yeah.
of whom yeah, they basically. Either don't have or can't be asked to find an actor yeah. to of that ethnicity to actually play the role.
Well,
it's
gone on for years, isn't it?
It has.
If
yeah.
you think of a different franchise that we love, Bond with a character of the same name, Khan. Kamal Khan in yes. Octopussy.
Yes.
He's a French actor.
Yeah, played by an Afghan prince played by a French actor.
Yeah.
yeah. Absolutely. Or Joseph Wiseman.
Yes.
Who is not half Chinese.
No.
And yet plays Dr. No, who is yeah. half Chinese. And yeah, so it's a thing that happened. I mean, I love the old Doctor Who's from the 1970s,
yes.
Tom Baker Doctor
yeah.
Who's. If you ever watch the episode of Talons of Wen Chiang, you know, the portrayal of Chinese people in that episode is deeply offensive.
Yeah.
And the principal actor, villain who plays Chinese, that plays Wang, not Wang Chiang, I can't remember the name of it, but it doesn't matter, is a European
yeah.
who is made up to look like a Chinaman, in quotes. And it's to watch it now is absolutely hideous, although it's still actually a very fondly regarded episode.
Don't forget all of the Fu Manchu films with Christopher Lee.
Yeah. Dear God. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. So it was definitely a thing back then. You can judge it according to your own moral codes. You're free to judge them there. What we do know is that he was absolutely magnificent as Khan, and he completely owned the role.
Yeah, completely.
And we can't disagree with any of that, can we?
Yeah. Interestingly, when it was first written, that role, it was meant to be an Orion. An Aryan, wasn't it? It was meant to be a Scandinavian. Ericsson was his name.
Ericsson, indeed.
Really?
Yeah.
I think okay. its name changed from Harold to John. I think somewhere along the lines in early drafts, which does lend you into that, as you said earlier, about the whole sort of like Nazi Germany thing, and that also gets you when you start calculating back when you're talking about a story set well, Khan's period of power was in the 1990s. So if this is eugenics, when was he born? Was he born in the late 1940s or early 1950s? Is this an overthrow? Is this a project that was carried on after the
boys
war,
from or, Brazil?
Yeah, exactly. That sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, as you can probably imagine, there's a considerable amount of side canon attached.
Oh,
to
I'm sure. Oh, yeah. I'd imagine there is.
Not
loads
all
of it.
Which I haven't read, if I'm yeah. being blunt. But I think there's a trilogy of books that was written about it, which explains all that backstory, and I'm sure it's probably not too far away from what you say.
Yeah.
But it does raise really interesting questions about the role of ex-Nazis after the Second World War, or actually not ex-Nazis, actual Nazis who were then rehabilitated into the US, the UK, and to the Soviet Union to do various things, and that eugenics was one of them.
And I suppose that if he had been a Scandinavian, the parallels would have been too obvious. And I think making him Indian, making him Sikh, albeit played by a Mexican, you've got Ricardo Montalban comes in there, and as soon as it's cast, I think they see that the character has so much more potential.
Mm.
And so when he's first written, that he's actually just a thug, really. He's just someone who is not of the Indian archaic type.
No.
he is actually just someone who takes what he wants and is basically a Viking, or the classic imagination of what a Viking is, and just goes in and just takes what he wants. But what you've actually got is as the script has been finessed through very, very many drafts, and I'm sure we'll come on to that later, you get a character that is really complex. And again, it's something we always go back to on this podcast is how brilliantly the amount they managed to do that in a 45-minute drama.
Yeah, I know. It's just amazing. It's just, Derek, actually, before you say what you say, why don't you reflect on this? That scene that we talked about where they were talking about him, or in the briefing room, that they discovered who he actually was. They said that you know, finding nobility in what he had done. A necessary part of the episode and the story, isn't it? Because we, the audience, we know what happens to Khan at the end of the he's let go, basically. Because he's, you know, and in order to justify that, I think it's necessary to be able to be for the audience to understand that actually this guy's awful, yes. A murderer, yes. But there's an element of nobility in him, and so we should be able to forgive him.
They lay the groundwork quite early on, actually, before you even see Botany Bay. Well, just when you see Botany Bay, when you see the second guest star in this, which is
Marla MacIver,
in her studio, in her, well, her own quarters, where she's got paintings of gladiators, and also I think there's a picture of like Napoleon and stuff like this, all littered around. So the idea is that they're setting up the character, her interest in the character, that she's interested in people of that sort of heroic archetype, because she's a professor, or she's a historian of 20th century, you know, and she has already been captured by that sort of the heroic ideal, and they've already painted that before you actually see.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It is beautiful storytelling.
Literally painted it.
It is beautiful storytelling, isn't it? Because because it is in such a short space of time. One of the weaker aspects of the episode for me is that for me the arc, the relationship arc between Marla and Khan, is for me a little bit too short, and I'm not 100% sold on how Marla has been able to become so enamoured with Khan to the extent that she's willing to betray her comrades in such a short space of time. And for me, I think there was an unproduced scene in the script, wasn't there, in which she does talk to another. Yes. Another member of the crew and
another female
more.
Member of the crew.
Yeah, and so, they have failing the Bechdel test because they're talking about her
relationship.
And so presumably that's why they cut it out. But maybe if they'd actually included that, then we might have been a little bit more convinced. That said, I'm probably being hypercritical. No.
I think you're. I think. A modern day observation of the relationship building between the two is it's certainly a bit strained, but it is done very, very quick. It's very, very, very compressed. I know there was talk, I think, in early scripts that Khan would have some kind of mental power. And so I think that was sort of the may have sort of crept in a little bit of that about, and then it just turns into just his sheer magnetism and just charisma. But yes, you're right. I mean, like, she does act like she's already got the SETI worm has already wrapped itself around her cerebral cortex.
Well, she went a bit soft focused. That's always the giveaway.
Yeah, it's always a giveaway. Yeah.
I hoped you might guide me to our dinner engagement. Very good. Fine technique.
It's a gladiator named Flavius. He wants.
And you've rearranged your hair for me.
It is disappointing, I suppose. It's a disappointing arc for a strong, clearly intelligent, educated professional who then just swoons before this strapping man. I mean, should we be disappointed in her?
But actually, if you watch that first scene when she's in her quarters and she's just about to put a penny on to start painting, she's actually called in to join the away team, and you can see it's an absolute chore.
Her shoulders drop.
Shoulders drop. She's like, oh great, I'm on the way. And so you sort of think, she really doesn't want to be on a starship anyway, does she?
Yeah, she's probably only doing this because she gets a grant, basically, to do her research.
Well, I think either that or she's got a thing about powerful blokes in uniform, and I think that's probably why she only joined up Starfleet and thought, actually, no, they're all just dicks.
There's there is a whole sinister element of, like, the future of Earth in the future is that the only way you can get a grant, an academic grant, is to join the military. And service guarantee citizenship about the whole thing.
It's also very misogynistic anyway.
You're right, Derek, it is. You know, it is,
but,
yeah.
I mean, the funny thing is that the other female character that you have in this is Uhura. Mm. And she actually has a couple of little bits in it, you know, where she, you know, the first bit is where actually she's castigated by Kirk, you know, and she's put down for him because she, you know, she doesn't know her Morse code properly and all that sort of stuff at the beginning, you know, the sort of SOS and the, I didn't know what a CQ was anyway either, so a CQ message, but she is admonished by Kirk. But then again, she stands up to the interrogation sequence later on.
Yeah.
And she does a good job there where she won't back down. She's a strong woman bit there. You know, I mean, it's a good episode to actually see a bit more of the crew behave.
Yeah, it's more of a, it is because it's its first season, and so you do have these quite nice ensemble episodes that dot through the first season, but they get fewer and fewer, sadly, and they're almost gone completely by the, by the second season.
But it is a still three-part thing with Kirk, Khan and McGivens, you know, which is good.
I think what we'll do is we'll talk a little bit more about Khan and their relationship with MacGyvers, because it is a really interesting one.
Yeah.
I mean, there's great, the two actors worked together before, didn't they, Graham?
They did, yeah. They'd worked 5 years earlier on Bonanza.
Madeline Rue, I should say, is the actress who played.
And they were playing a husband and wife. They were both playing Native Americans.
Both playing Native Americans.
Yes.
God.
Neither of them being Native Americans.
Neither
American,
of them, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So they'd actually work together. They would work again together as well in the early 80s on Fantasy Island as well. She appeared as a guest on there as well, which obviously he was the regular.
He was indeed, yes, a series regular. Yeah, I mean, there's great chemistry going on between those two.
Yes.
And you can really feel it. And I mean, those early sequences, particularly with the hair where he's seeking to dominate her.
I'd like some historical information about your ship. Its purpose and...
And why do you wear your hair in such an uncomplimentary fashion?
It's comfortable.
But it's not attractive.
Control her. It's very creepy.
Oh yeah.
Massively
coercive.
It's actually uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
But it should be. It's supposed to be. I mean, it is. I mean, he is seducing and coercing this woman into bending her to his will so that he can take control of the ship. It's part of it. Mm. I mean, obviously, he then, in his own way, falls in love with her, and I don't know what message you take away from that. Probably best not to think about it, but of course, because she goes with him down onto Centi Alpha 5. but anyway, that's another story, I guess. Can we talk a little bit about Khan's relationship with Kirk?
Yeah.
Because I think it's great.
Yes, it is.
I love the scenes between those two. Let's talk about the dinner. One of my favourite scenes in that episode is the dinner.
Yeah, I know. It is one of the best scenes with Kirk, actually, in the first series and by definition the whole series.
It helps define Kirk and his command abilities, isn't it? And why he's the boss.
And especially why he's got Spock as his first officer.
Yeah.
And when you have Spock as your first officer, use him.
Yeah. And it's great because Khan knows what Kirk is doing.
Yeah.
Because obviously he calls him out and tells you
You are an excellent tactician, Captain. You let your second in command attack while you sit and watch for weakness.
You have a tendency to express ideas in military terms, Mr. Khan. This is a social occasion.
It has been said that social occasions are only warfare concealed. Many prefer it more honest, more open.
You fled. Why? Were you afraid?
I've never been afraid.
But you left at the very time mankind needed courage.
We offered the world order.
And then he still falls for it, though.
Yeah.
And then he goes, oh, excellent. And
then again, you can see the frustration because, like, they're telling him about the 20th century.
Yeah, don't tell me. I know something of those days.
Yeah. But that's what makes that scene really clever. It's because, obviously, the people around that table, the ones who know about the 20th century, are Khan and everyone watching at home.
Yeah.
So you're bringing your own biases from the 20th century. You're looking at seeing what he is. You may not be from 1996 if you're from 1966 America, but you're watching that and thinking, right, okay, I know who you are. You're evil. You're the bad guy. But there is this whole sense of, well, they don't know who he is. Or do they? Or are they guessing? Or what are they trying to get out of him?
Yeah, and I think because they rewrote the character quite a lot, I think the contemporary audience wasn't really aware of who it might have been. I think it might have been a bit more on the lows if they had stuck with the original, sort of like the idea of an Ericsson, a kind of Aryan, kind of like, you know, clearly European Nazi kind of figure.
Yeah.
Whereas they went in a different direction there. But I mean, he the thing that I like about Kirk's sort of relationship with him is that they also, I mean, every time they speak, you just the story grows a bit, the characters flesh out a little bit more, and there's just great chemistry going on between Mantleman and Shatner as well, isn't there? In what is actually only 2 or 3 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, well, they are. It is Sherlock and Moriarty through this, because they're supposed to be that they are the equals, because they're both captains or leaders of their own people and do care for them as well. Even though you don't see as much about the care, you know, Khan caring. Later on, we find how much he cares for his crew. I mean, there's a little bit about the amount of crew that they've lost through the voyage, obviously. It's also interesting that in this episode, you see they're actually the same height. As well, which is quite interesting. You know, Shatner and Ricardo Montalban are actually the same height, so that, you know, they're physically, they're not too dissimilar.
Yeah, Montalban's got a hell of a lot more screen presence, hasn't he?
But that's the other thing. He's got a different way. He emanates sort of like real acting chops, but also sort of that nobility, just like. Oozes off him.
A bearing, doesn't
he? Yeah, he does.
Yeah, because that's right. I mean, he's been engineered to have a superior.
You know, and
bearing.
Obviously, Kirk does actually, through, as you said, from the dinner when they have it and have the dinner, is that he is the statesman. You know, he looks like he's letting all his staff do all the work while he just stays there and just analyses what's happening.
Yep. You know. Looks for weaknesses and then strikes. Yeah.
And you know, and
the other supporting cast don't necessarily, like Spock and McCoy, don't have that much to do in this, although they do have, like that dinner scene is a good scene with Spock, and there's some characteristically enjoyable bridge sequences, but McCoy has an excellent scene with Kirk.
Oh yeah, well he steals the show almost. Yeah. Really.
Well, either choke me or cut my throat, make up your mind. English. I thought I dreamed hearing it. Where am I?
You're it.
You're in bed, holding a knife at your doctor's throat. Answer my question. It would be most effective if you would cut the carotid artery just under the left ear.
With that dialogue there, because a lot of the time McCoy doesn't get great dialogue.
No.
He's either being the chump in the room, the one who really doesn't understand the big picture, his role is often like the person at home, isn't he? Really?
Yeah.
Why don't we just do this?
Yeah. The everyman, as Derek refers to him. Yeah.
But obviously he does come across as being the idiot sometimes, because obviously he's not as smart as Spock or as Kirk. But in this one, he really does. He has, and that is a fantastic.
Yeah, he's got balls of steel, isn't he?
Yeah. And it is real genuine.
Yeah. All of the Starfleet characters are courageous in this movie. They're all of them are unshrinking, even MacGyver's.
Yeah.
Despite the extraordinary psychological pressure that she's been placed under by Khan, in the end she actually goes, well, she saves Kirk, rescues Kirk, and starts the recovery of the Enterprise. Everybody, so you can make an argument that although MacGyver's turns, she is coerced into doing so.
Yeah.
And actually, when the chips are down, she has the courage to be able to then turn back. And rectify matters, and I think that's a really cool message that they've got going on there. It probably a good opportunity to just refer quickly to the script. It's written by a chap called Cary
Wilbur,
an established screenwriter, but with significant rewrites by Gene Kuhn and later Gene Roddenberry. In fact, Gene Roddenberry wanted to have his name added to the script. But the Screenwriters Guild said no, because of the number of rewrites into it. And I think the whole eugenics thing and that might have been more of a Gene Coon thing. I don't know whether or not you've got any info on that.
No, I don't know. I mean, he was obviously this Superman. I mean, like that was in Wilbur's original script that he'd come from the 20th century. Actually, I think he originally was 2096.
Right.
And I think they shrunk it back to 1996.
To make it within...
Make it seem a bit more edgy and a bit more sort of like he's from the near future. And like he's actually probably alive now while you're watching this. If you think of it that way, then that's there's obviously an added zing there than if you just say 2096, because that's like, even for us, that's like ridiculous distance away. So there was a lot of things. From what I know, from what I've read about it, a lot of the stuff that they changed in was sort of the typical stuff that they would change at the time. So a lot of space stuff. I think they threw Kirk out of the ship at one point.
Oh really?
I think he was basically the space version of Keelhaul.
I do remember reading that the original's treatment was very expensive.
Yeah.
And there's consequently, yes, it had to be written down and down because it's basically another bottle episode, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is obviously expensive because they've got good guests in there. They've got established guest stars.
Yes.
And they've also got a lot of extras in this. There are a lot of extras, so a lot of costumes. Actually, Khan holds the record, I think, for having the most number of costumes of a male character.
Right.
I think he has 5 different costumes.
He obviously brought quite a wardrobe with him, didn't he?
So,
in his DY-100 class vessel.
Yeah.
They let him pack a wardrobe.
Bill had a lot of fun with Ricardo, didn't he? Yeah, so he's and they put him in Starfleet uniform. I never really got why they did that.
I mean they put him in fatigues. it was Starfleet. Yeah. I would have thought that they would have put him in. I tell you what happened. Well, I know what happened. It's the only thing that could fit him.
Yeah.
It would have been. They probably what they wanted. They looked at maybe those uniforms that were in what a little girl's made of.
Right.
In those ones, they probably thought, yeah, we'll just stick him in one of them. I said, oh, he doesn't fit. I said, oh, well, we'll just stick him in a Starfleet uniform.
The stuff that Ted Cassidy wore.
Yeah, exactly. Which would have been awesome. But, I mean, yeah. I mean, no. I mean, Ted Cassidy was never going to get into there. Never going to get into that. Obviously, the conclusion... I'm going to head to the conclusion and probably think about wrapping up soon. So if there is any burning things you want to get off your chest about this, then come forward. But I mean, just on the conclusion, I mean, the references to Milton, I think, are very nice. And I mean, is it an elegant solution, do you think, to like, you know, I mean, this man is shouldn't be forgotten. Although, you know, there were no massacres under his reign, he was a dictator, he was brutal, and he was clearly, you know, a escaping justice.
Yeah.
Because they commandeered a ship and escaped. I mean, would it not have been wiser to have taken him back to a star base and maybe had a trial?
Well, yeah, I think what you see is Kirk being his own little tin pot dictator, isn't it? When he decides what's best for the galaxy by putting these 72 very, very dangerous people on
just,
the planet.
Just off you go. Just see what you can do with this. And say, well, you want, hang on, really? I mean, I don't know whether or not there's way. I mean, although in fairness, Derek, we are looking back on that and saying, well, maybe what they should have done is have taken the nearest star base. And then, but then that's because we've got hundreds of episodes of Star Trek baked into and thinking that that's what would have happened if this was an episode of Discovery. But it's an episode of first season Star Trek. I mean, it's an emerging franchise. So actually, the idea that they were out on the frontiers of space.
But they're heading towards a star base anyway, aren't they?
That's true, actually, because they were going to drop them off.
They are actually going in the right direction.
But the idea about taking a load of superhumans back into, you know, onto a star base, which is even, you know, when
that's
you...
the thinking, isn't it? See, we're thinking, once I turn these guys loose on someone else, do they have, will they have?
If we put them in a correctional facility, they'll overtake it and then...
Yeah,
and then
they'll end up running the place.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What do you do with these people? Do you either split them up? You probably can't... And also, you know, are there going to be disreputable people back on Earth who would actually think, or elsewhere, who would think, or actually wouldn't mind taking a blood sample from that guy and having a little look and seeing what he's made of? Maybe he just felt it would be better to just, like, banish them.
The retro canon would be that the idea about sort of, you know, the retrocanon in that we know that in Star Trek the pillars of some of these parts, well, sorry, some of these sort of this episode have become pillars of Star Trek universe with the case of eugenics and so on, and what you treat, how you treat these characters and these type of people, as you see in later episodes of the franchise. But the idea about putting them on, well, it was the SS Botany Bay, and the idea about putting them, I think it was actually a very neat conclusion to it. You know, the idea that these people were escaping or became sort of convicts, and then putting them onto their own little Australia. You know, I think it actually works really well.
It's an elegant solution to the. It's nice to tie up the story.
And, as far as that's concerned, one of my favourite bits in the episode is where Spock points out the huge obvious flaw in the story, where they say, like, well, why on earth would you spend all that resources putting all these people on the spaceship anyway?
Yeah,
and that's never really.
I mean, I think that my assumption is that they had the resources themselves. They had access to the ship and were running rather than. Yeah. You know, and it kind of, you know, Kirk refers to it earlier, he says, you know, you fled, why? Were you afraid? You know, and, you know, so I think that we can go from there. But yeah, I mean, it's an awful lot to get into a very small storyline. So
going back to the retro history, and the side canon, those three, the trilogy, brought in Gary Seven into the series as well.
Right, interesting.
And the formation of their nation, as they did, and as you've just pointed out, they had the resources and they escaped, you know, because they had to, because of what was happening on Earth. So, you know, it's been retconned.
Yeah, I imagine that I'm sure
lots of people have put a lot of thought into it.
Yes, and that's fine. That kind of thinking is perfectly healthy and in no way a waste of time. Just like listening to Star Trek podcast, well, which is in no way a waste of time.
I want to go back actually to one other thing. Is that I gave you a book, The Best of Trek, which was a compilation of old 1960s and 70s fanzine articles, and one of my favourites was in there was actually the history of the Federation, and there is a nice little chunk about the eugenics war in there, and that's why I've always found
I'm sorry I didn't take the time to read it.
Well, you can read it
at
it's
your on
leisure.
My shelf, and I will read it at my leisure. Spock at the end says it would be really interesting to go back and see what seed you've sown, you know, this day, and of course they never do they? And there are obviously consequences.
one unseen crew member in that episode does go back there, doesn't he? Obviously.
Yes, in the end, he goes back and discovers the Botany Bay.
No,
Botany Bay. So I mean, unfortunately, Captain Kirk, or indeed Admiral Kirk, doesn't bother to check on their progress, and there's consequences for that, which we will discuss in our next episode.
Yeah,
because we're next the episode we're going to talk about the sequel to The Space Seed, and that is of course Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, which is one of the best films ever and one of the best Star Trek films ever. But we're not going to talk about now because we're working up a thirst. I think we're going to have a few drinks and talk about something else. So unless you guys have got anything that you need to unload into the microphones about Space Seed,
just one little tiny interesting
this
point.
Is he's about to hit us with a massive hot take.
No, not actually, this is just a very 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 mundane little thing though, but the design for the Botany Bay ship is actually older in real terms than the design of the Enterprise.
Oh really?
Yes. It was.
Go on. Is it Matt Jeffries?
Yes, and it was one of his first designs that he made, and he made it before he made the Enterprise. It'd just been sitting around on his shelf.
So he's just like he had a design of it there,
and he said one that was old, and he thought, right, this one can be your old ship. This one can be.
I've seen some really nice renderings of a DY-100 laden with cargo. Which is sort of like with cargo holders like attached to it going back in a train all the way back. It looks really, really cool. Some nice work there. It's a gorgeous. I mean, Matt Jeffries, we could do a whole podcast on on him, one of the cornerstones of the franchise.
We probably will.
And we probably
Why
will.
Not? Let's do our own Trek Yard.
We'll do our own Trek Yard. Trek Yards for that kind of thing. If you're not already across them, literally hours of fun there. Right. Okay. That's enough, chaps. Wonderful. Thanks very much for your time, gents. And from myself, Terry, and from Graham and from Derek. Until next time, it's goodbye.
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 But if you will excuse me, gentlemen, ladies, I grow fatigued again.